now. Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello and welcome to another special edition of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner. Well, there are people who inspire and there are people who are like our next guest in the direst of circumstances, somehow muster the strength to triumph over adversity. This great Australian is living proof that with a determined and never say die attitude, no obstacle is too big to overcome. It is my pleasure to welcome to Great Australian Lives one of the most inspiring people we've ever had on the show, Tahria Pitt. Tahria, welcome. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me, Laura. It's an honour to be on the show.
Oh, well, it's an honour to have you. You have such a remarkable story. For those who are listening who don't know Tahria's name, of course, you have risen to fame with your incredible attitude to surviving after you were caught up in a shocking bushfire over in Western Australia many years ago now. But you suffered burns to 65% of your body, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And really, really horrific injuries, but managed to fight back. And I believe you actually died on the operating table three times, is that right?
Yes, that's right, yep.
And here we are talking about it all these years later.
Yeah.
How are you going?
Everything with me is going really well. I was just chatting to you briefly before the show started, Laura, about your beautiful twins, and I've had a beautiful baby boy as well.
Yes.
But he's 15 months old now, so it goes really quickly. I know everyone says that, but...
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, it does fly by.
Hakavai,
yes. Yeah, so is a Tahitian name.
Yes, because your mum's Tahitian, isn't she?
My mum's Tahitian. I was born in Tahiti.
Right.
And so it means... So haka, like the Māori dance, the haka, that means dance. Mm-hmm. And vai in Tahitian is water.
Oh,
so
beautiful.
It's dance of the water. Oh. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And how we got that name, Michael and I, Michael's my beautiful partner. You know, after I got burnt, we said to ourselves, in 3 years, we're going to sail around Tahiti and all of her islands. Oh. And that was a really good goal for us because it gave us a lot of hope. You know, when things are hard, we'd say, oh, well, one day we'll be sailing around Tahiti and the islands.
Yeah.
So we went to Tahiti and I met this beautiful little baby boy. And his name was Hakavai.
Right.
And so I said to Michael, if we ever have a baby and if we ever have a son, I want to call him Hakavai.
Yep. And how did he respond?
Oh, he was all for it.
Oh, that's beautiful. Some people have a lot of trouble naming their children with getting both parents to agree. So that's on you, Michael.
Yeah, well, he's a keeper.
Yeah, yeah, he absolutely is. We'll talk a lot about him during the show. What I want to talk about first, though, Tahria, is your book, Good Selfie.
Yes,
This is for teens.
That was my baby before I had a real life baby. Yeah.
Tell me about it.
I guess how it came about, you know, when I was pregnant with Hakavai, I just started to think about what sort of messages I wanted to pass on to him, because I think, you know, as parents, of course, we all want our kids to be happy. But when I sort of thought about that a little bit more, I thought, well, that's not really a realistic expectation, because it's not possible to be happy all of the time. You know, like Hakavai, he might not make sports teams, he might fail at things, he might not get the marks he wants. So I think more than happiness, I want to instill in him a sense of self-belief and resilience. And I guess how the book came about, I get asked questions all of the time, and a lot of them came from kids and teens, and I started to notice that there was really similar themes in them. And the questions were like, how do you get through your hard times? You know, I don't look like people I see on Instagram, and it makes me feel really bad about myself. So the book is just the responses to all of those questions.
Yep. Because being a parent, a new parent as you are and as I am, it is a real concern, the age of social media. I don't know how I would have ever survived as a teenager with that in existence. It really would eat away at the self-esteem of a young person. So does your book address that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, there's a really cool question in the book. It's from Katie, and she asks that question. She says, I don't look like all of the girls on Instagram, and every time I go on, I feel like crap. And my response to it was, you know, one of the questions I get asked all the time, Laura, is how am I so confident? And I know people don't mean that in a nasty way, but I think what they mean is how am I so confident when I look so different? And I believe there's a really strong misconception that, you know, the better we look, the more confidence we'll have.
It's often the opposite.
Yeah, well, I call BS on that, because there's nothing wrong with taking pride in your appearance and wanting to present the best version of yourself to the world. But I think I just try to emphasize that I don't want people to fall into that trap of thinking they have to look like a perfect, airbrushed, highly filtered, highly edited Instagram person to be normal. Mm. And so one of the really awesome activities in the book is I have this thing called a confidence pie, and it lists all of the different facets that the kids could get their confidence from. And I use me as an example. So, for example, one facet of where I get my confidence from, yeah, it's my appearance. But then it's also my intelligence and how well my business is doing, you know, my relationships with my friends and family, you know, giving back to the community, all the work I do with Interplast. And I think when you start breaking it down like that, you see that there are a lot of areas that you get your confidence from.
I from one of your TED Talks, or a TED Talk I watched of yours, you mentioned that, you know, we're all much bigger than our body that we're in.
Yeah.
Is that's sort of the same sort of thing, isn't it, that theme?
Yeah, and I'm not going to say that appearance doesn't matter, because, you know, I was on TV this morning, and if I had rocked up in UGG boots and didn't brush my hair and didn't brush my teeth.
Nothing wrong with UGG boots.
Yeah, but I wouldn't have felt as confident, and I wouldn't have felt as capable. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with wanting to look your best and taking pride in your appearance, but don't think that's the only way you can get confidence from.
And that's obviously, you're going to teach all these sorts of things to your beautiful little boy. Was he the inspiration for this book?
I wouldn't say he was the inspiration. It was just, you know, all of the questions I've gotten off kids and teens over the past 8 or so years, you know, what they say to me in the street, or emails I get from them, or the little notes on social media. I just noticed that there was some common themes. And then when I was pregnant, I just started to really think about it a little bit more and think about what messages I would want to pass on to my son. And, you know, it's awesome because I've got this book now which I can share all across Australia.
How is he? How is your little boy, Akavai?
He's awesome. Look, I think it's a bit early to tell, like, what his personality is going to be like. But he's great. He's awesome.
How has it changed? I mean, you and your partner has such an active life before he came along. You know, you're an incredible athlete, aside from all the challenges that you've faced. He must have changed things for you, though, your little boy.
Yeah, well, I think it's just your priorities shift, don't they, Laura?
Yeah.
Like, you know, I don't want to go do an 8-hour-long bike ride in the rain anymore. Like, I'd rather spend that time with my family. So I think definitely your priorities change, and you almost have to adjust your expectations of what's achievable throughout the day. But I did coast to coast, the Kathmandu coast to coast race recently in New Zealand. It was about 2 months ago now, and that's a, you know, crazy ass adventure race from the west coast to the east coast. And I did the mountain run part of it, and the mountain run, it was 30 kilometers. And, you know, it wasn't the hardest race I'd ever done, and it wasn't the longest race, but I was really proud of myself, Laura, because, you know, there was all those challenges along the way. Like, you know, sometimes I had to put Huckavai in the pram and take him with me. Sometimes I had to get up at 4, while the whole house was asleep. So, you know, I managed to work through all of those things, and that's why when I finished, you know, it wasn't the hardest, but I think I was probably the proudest I've been after a race.
I could take a leaf out of your book then, for sure, because I'm sort of struggling with that at the moment. How on earth do you maintain your fitness when you've got, you know, little children? It's
well,
so
I mean,
hard.
You've got two, mate. So,
well, they both go in the one pram, but you've got to, you know, your priorities do change. But it's a very hard juggling act, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think your priorities change and your expectations need to adjust. And, you know, some days I couldn't do my training session you know, because I had Huckabye, and I think that's okay too.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Now you were an Ulla Dulla girl in the very beginning, weren't you? You spent your childhood on coastal New South Wales.
Yeah, well, I had a very idyllic childhood. You know, I used to watch the surf from my bedroom window, and I'd wake up in the morning, and I'd look out the window, and I'd check the surf, and if it was good, we'd all get out there before school, and Mum would be on the balcony calling us in to have breakfast and be quick so we wouldn't miss the bus.
How Aussie.
So, I know, but yeah, I had a really awesome, idyllic childhood. I'm very thankful for it.
And you attended Ulla Dulla Public School and high school. That's actually where you met Michael, your partner, isn't it?
Yeah, well, Michael was my brother's best friend.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I've known him for a long time.
Yeah.
And you know how you always have... Look, if you're a girl, you usually have a crush on your older brother's friends.
I didn't have a brother.
Okay, well, I always had a crush on Michael even when I was,
younger.
I was 12, and he worked at the local grocery store with my brother.
Yep.
But it wasn't until we were a bit older that we finally got together.
Yeah, and he as has been well documented, has been so beautifully dedicated to helping you recover and loyal to you, hasn't he?
Yeah, and I think that's what's awesome. You know, I'm at such a good point now where he's got his life back as well.
Yeah.
Because he put his life on hold for years while he was helping me and supporting me through my recovery. Mm. And so it's so awesome that now he's able to go and do the things that he wants to do and the things that he wants to achieve.
Yeah, and that would be great for his psychology on top of yours
for
as
sure.
well. You don't want to be
for
feeling
sure.
like you're holding someone back.
No.
Now, you, speaking of being of ability and that sort of thing, we know full well that this all happened to you, when you were running an ultra marathon. But you've for a long time been a very dedicated athlete, haven't you? Even when you were young.
I was never great at sport at school. Like, I was good, but I was never, I was never like the age champion or anything
right.
that.
Yeah, right.
I liked running. You know, and I liked surfing and I liked, I just liked being active, but I wasn't, like I said, age champion or anything.
Yeah.
I just did it because I enjoyed it.
Yeah. Where did engineering come into things for you? Was that always a passion? You ended up at university doing your Bachelor of Science and engineering?
Yeah, so I did a double degree. I think, at school my grades were pretty mediocre, and then I decided I really wanted to do well in my leaving certificate. And I decided I wanted to be an engineer when I left school. And so I knew to be an engineer you had to do subjects like maths and maths extension and physics and chemistry. Ugh. And I had those subject choices down, and I showed one of my teachers, Mr. Smith, and he laughed at me and he said, "Oh, Taria, you're not smart enough to do those subjects."
Did he really say that?
Yeah, but he did me a massive favour, Laura.
Yeah.
Because whenever I felt overwhelmed by study or whenever I wanted to give up, I would just really focus on how much I wanted to prove him wrong.
Right.
And I came first in all of my subjects. I got the math medal and I got a mark in the high 90s. So.
Oh, well, Mr. Smith, I hope you're listening.
Yeah, go suck it, Mr. Smith.
I can't tell Taria she can't do something. That's incredible. So upon being very successful in doing that and going to university, you and Michael end up in WA. Is that because you wanted to work in the mining industry?
Yeah, so I got an awesome job at the Argyle Diamond Mine in the Kimberley region, and it's quite a prestigious mine to work at. Mm-hmm. So I jumped at the opportunity and Michael came over with me as well.
And was he doing the similar thing, or what was he doing?
No, he used to be in the police.
Oh, right.
He used to be a New South Wales police officer.
There you go.
So he worked in Maroubra in Sydney, and I went to university in Sydney at the University of New South Wales.
Yep.
And so they,
at the same go, time, sorry, at the same time, no, you were doing a bit of modelling on the side as well. Was that just to get you through university?
Yeah, and look, I got to say, I wasn't a very good model.
Weren't you? You didn't love it?
No, I didn't love it, and I wasn't good at it. So,
why do you say that?
I just never got booked.
Oh,
so if you're not getting booked, what does that mean?
So what?
I also found it, the feedback from castings, I also found that really frustrating because, you're either... too skinny or not athletic enough or too athletic or too surfy. And I found that, I thought I was enough how I was.
Yeah.
But that was pure. Yeah, that was purely just to get me through uni.
And that's a hard industry to be in if you're not, not totally dedicated to, you know, the whole modelling thing.
And you know, like models these days, they're extraordinary business people. Mm. You know, they have to maintain a social media presence and they're very savvy. Mm. Yeah, so credit to them.
Well, there's plenty more still to come on Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives. Up next, we'll learn how a grass fire in an ultramarathon event changed Taria Pitt's life. Stay with us. Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives. And tonight we are celebrating the extraordinary life of Taria Pitt. Now, Taria, we mentioned at the opening of the show, that event that you have spoken so much about over the years that we'll talk about tonight. And, of course, that is back in September 2011 when you were part of a 100-kilometre ultramarathon through the Kimberleys in WA, where you were living, of course, we've just talked about. But though that day is obviously etched in history as one that dramatically changed your life. You have talked about this so many times. Did you have any idea on that day the danger that was looming?
No.
Nothing at all?
No.
So you, for those who are listening who don't, aren't aware or wouldn't remember, you were part of this ultramarathon. It was a hot day, wasn't it? It was about 30 degrees.
Well, yeah, it's the Kimberleys.
Yeah, so it's going to be a hot day.
Yeah.
And you, from my knowledge, you were running along sort of on your own. Did you have earphones in?
Yeah, I had earphones in.
Okay, so you're listening to music and weren't aware of what was up ahead.
Yeah, so I was listening to the music. I was in the zone. I was running through a gorge. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that there was people congregated around. There were six of us. Mm-hmm. And then I noticed that there was a fire fastly approaching. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've heard of the Venturi effect, Laura, but basically when you get air and you compress it into a smaller space, which was the gorge, that air acts as a suction. Mm. Right? So we were in the gorge. We could see the fire coming. We could either go back the way we came, which had really high grass up to around my shoulder, so perfect fuel for the flames, or we could run up the side of the gorge where there was less grass, but fire travels faster going uphill. Mm. Yeah, yeah. So they were our options.
Before that, though, you obviously didn't hear or see it at all until it was too late. Is that right? You heard something, but you didn't know it was fire?
I didn't really hear, no.
Okay. Did you heard a loud noise though and thought it was traffic or road trains nearby?
Well, I had my earplugs in.
Mm, okay. So you get to the point where it's too late, obviously.
Yes.
Yeah. And those around you have happened to them too.
Yes.
And you have a conversation, how do we get out of this? And did you decide at that point to take the hill?
That's the way I chose.
Mm. And what happened next?
Well, we ran up the side of the hill and, fires move at an incredibly fast rate. Mm. So I'd say it was fruitless. Mm. Ran up the side of the hill. The fire quickly engulfed me. Mm. I remember looking down at my hands and arms and they were both ablaze. But then after what seemed like, only a couple of seconds, the fire had passed.
Right.
And I was still alive. So I got a real surge of adrenaline that I had survived.
Right. And what happened next? Did you, I know you would have called for help, but it took a long time, didn't it?
Yeah, I don't really remember what happened next, though. I don't think I'm the best memory witness for that because I'd just gone through something pretty horrific.
Yes, okay.
So what, my sense of time was distorted and dilated.
Mm. Yeah. So what we know is that you or those with you did call for help, but it took around 4 hours for them to get to you. And I was watching an interview that you'd done a few years ago where you mentioned that one of those who came to your aid was someone you actually knew. Is that right? A volunteer who you recognised?
Yeah, so exactly, yeah, because I used to volunteer with the paramedics in town.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And when you saw her, is that when you realised how bad your injuries were?
I don't think so, Laura, because I think that's part of the body's protective mechanism.
Right.
You know, like it's when you go through something incredibly traumatic, you're not really thinking rationally and you're not really thinking logically.
Mm.
So I don't think it was, you know, when I saw her, I said, "Oh, hey, Bonnie, it's Taria," and she started to cry,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't piece together that she may have been crying because she saw how bad I was.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
Yep.
So they flew you out of there.
Yeah, they chopped us out. You know, and the chopper pilot who rescued us, you know, he never really gets talked about, but I really think he's the unsung hero out of all of this because, you know, he balanced his chopper on one skid. He took Kate, he flew her out of there, he came back, he balanced on one skid again. He took me, he flew me out, he picked up Kate, and then he choppered us to the local hospital. And I walked in and I said, "Can someone please call my boyfriend? Can someone please call Michael?" And then next minute I woke up a month later in Concord Hospital in Sydney.
Unbelievable.
It is
shocking, isn't it, how burns injuries can affect the body in that sense that you can be walking at 1 minute and the next minute everything's different.
I don't know if it is shocking, Laura. Like I said, it's when people go through traumatic events, what they are able to do is astounding.
Mm.
So, I don't know if it's specific to burns.
Right.
I think it's, yeah, I think, you know, you hear people going through traumatic events all the time and they manage to lift a car up or, you know, survive for 3 weeks in the jungle.
While that adrenaline's in your body.
Yeah, you know, but I think that that's testament to the human spirit. You know, we're so resilient.
Yeah. And when you woke up a month later, as you said, where were you?
Concord in Sydney.
And what did they tell you when you woke up? What do you remember about those first few conversations?
Yeah, I guess there was no, like, real clear moment where I realised what had happened.
Mm.
I think, you know, Michael said they'd tell me one day and the next day I would forget and I would ask again. So I don't really remember this crystal clear moment where the realization of what had happened to me sunk in.
Yeah.
It wasn't like that at all. It was just piece by piece and bit by bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your one of your doctors has spoken quite candidly about how you know, other people he's treated with similar injuries to yours didn't survive. Does that, how do you feel about hearing that?
Grateful.
Yeah.
Really grateful to be given a second chance. Mm. You know, I look at my son and I think if I hadn't have survived, I never would have met him.
Yeah.
You know, neither would my mum. So I'm overwhelmingly grateful and I'm so thankful to live in a country like Australia where we've got access. You know, it's really easy to bag out our medical system, but I think when you compare it to the world, we've got one of the best medical systems and, you know, we've got access to some of the best medical care that we can get.
Mm.
And if it wasn't for my surgeons and that amazing medical team of doctors and nurses and surgeons and anaesthetists and physiotherapists, I wouldn't be here.
Yeah. And as we mentioned earlier, you actually, you know, did die in theatre 3 times and they brought you back.
Yeah.
So that shows how close you were to not being with us and how good they are at doing their job.
Yeah, they are phenomenal and they're so humble as well.
Mm.
Like they literally save people's lives every single day.
Mm.
I think that's amazing.
And they had to go to, or one of the doctors had to actually source skin for you from the US.
Yes, that's right, because there wasn't enough skin in Australia. And, you know, when the skin came over from the US, it actually got stopped at customs because at that time you couldn't import living human tissue.
Right.
And so my surgeon got on the phone and he said, "Look, if we don't get that skin this afternoon, this patient, she'll die."
Unbelievable. So
yeah.
How did that then get to you? Did they just say, "Okay, let it go," or was there further process to get it through?
I'm not quite sure. I'm pretty sure the customs people just let it through.
Yeah.
But so all of the skin on my body now is my own skin.
Yeah.
But what happens when you're burnt? They debride you, so they remove all of the burnt and dead skin. And skin, it's our main barrier to infection.
Mm-hmm.
So after they remove the skin, they've got to cover you with something.
Mm-hmm.
So they can use, you know, a plastic sort of skin substitute, but it's not as good as real human skin.
Right.
So they covered me with that donor skin or cadaver skin.
Yep.
While my own skin grew underneath.
Absolutely incredible what they can do.
Yeah, it's incredible. You know, then they take your donor skin and then they put it through a meshing machine, which expands it.
I've seen that. Is that the machine where it looks like they're rolling it like a rolling pin through
and it stretches it? Yeah, so and like all of the ratios of their skin stretch in my body are different.
Right.
So on your face, they don't stretch it because they want your face to look as...
taut.
As close to what it did as possible. Yeah. And if you've got a mesh mark on your face, it wouldn't be achieved. And then on my hands, the ratio is 1:1. So if you look really closely, you can see there's a bit of a mesh pattern. Mm-hmm. And then on my arms, I think the ratio is 1:3. And then on my legs, it's 1:5.
Speaking of your hands, I saw a joke that you made about one of your hands, that it's a Bart Simpson hand.
Yeah, well, I've only got four little stumpy fingers on that hand. But, you know, like I'm actually really proud of my hand. Like I can do everything that I used to be able to do. So,
And you've recovered incredibly well. I mean, I've seen talks with you where you talk about you tie your shoelaces easily now, and you know, use a pen and use a knife and fork, and but those things, well, obviously, a silly question, but to relearn those things, difficult.
Were you going to ask if they were hard? Yeah.
Yeah. As soon as the words came out of my mouth, I thought, of course they were.
Yes, Laura, I tell you, they were hard. It was hard to relearn, and it was frustrating.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you're an adult, independent person, and then all of a sudden you're relearning how to tie your shoelaces, of course that's frustrating.
And relying on other people when you're proud, as you say, independent person, very difficult.
Yeah, of course.
Now, Kate Sanderson, you mentioned earlier, she was the young woman who was with you when it happened. She was suffered horrific burns too. Yeah. You would have a strong connection with her, wouldn't you? You've been through something others haven't.
Well, you know what? We're all good friends, but I don't think we're friends because we were all, you know, burnt. I think it's because we all like similar things. You know what I mean? Like, we like running. We like endurance events. We like challenging ourselves. Mm-hmm. So Kate's phenomenal. She lost half of her foot, but she still did MDS, which is Marathon de Sable, over in Africa, amazing, which is a 250-kilometer ultramarathon through the Sahara Desert. And she did that on half a foot. So she's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah.
She's really humble as well. She's really humble as well. Yeah.
That's amazing that you've both continued on doing, you know, the things that you love and were passionate about before this event has happened. That's a testament.
Well, I think, you know, if you're passionate about something and you love something, you'll do everything in your power to be able to keep on doing it. Mm.
We saw, especially when you spoke to 60 Minutes years ago for the first time, you know, that you were wearing compression bandages for 23 hours a day, I think I remember, and the face mask as well, and how you actually took it off to reveal your face. Was that a daunting moment for you, or you'd seen it, you know, the difference in your appearance that many times that it wasn't a big deal for you?
Look, it was, you know, again, it's not like there was one moment where I just took off my mask and showed the entire planet. You know, it's just, you know, but it's just baby steps that you take every single day. So I'd take off my mask around friends and family. And then I'd take off my mask if I went for a walk around the block. And then I'd take off my mask when I went to the shops. You know, so it was just those incremental little baby steps which allowed me to be able to take it off on national TV. But I think you can't get to that point if you don't do all of those little previous incremental baby steps beforehand.
It's a powerful message you send by doing it too, isn't it? About appearance and confidence and self-worth.
I'm not sure if that's my intention. I guess it's just, you know, if you want something to happen and if that's your goal, you have to be able to and you've got to be willing to put in the work that precedes it. You know what I mean? You can't get to there if you don't do all of the steps beforehand that lead you up to that point. So I guess that's more my message, Laura. It's just about being able to just take those little steps every single day.
Be determined.
And be consistent. You know, and not be too hard on yourself when, you know, on a day you don't go and do your training session.
Yeah,
be a bit forgiving of yourself.
Be a bit forgiving and just and zoom out and just focus on the longer view and about how consistent you are over the long term.
Mm, interesting.
And I guess that they're all the messages that I've got in my book.
Yeah. Okay. That being more determinate and about the longer game.
Well, yeah, and just, you know, and don't get overwhelmed. Like, you know, I remember the first time I stood up again, the first time I had to stand, it was so painful. And I remember sobbing and crying all over my physio. And that point was really overwhelming for me, Laura, because I thought, well, I can't even stand up by myself. Mm. So how the hell am I going to be able to walk again, run again, compete again, go back to work? Mm. You know, so if I just kept focusing on getting my life back, I would have been demoralized and I would have been overwhelmed. Mm. So I just thrust that out of my mind and I'd focus on literally taking things one day at a time.
Yeah.
When I'd get through that day, I'd say to myself, well done, Tere, you did it.
Yep.
You survived another day.
Yep. Incredible stuff.
And so it's not rocket science, and it doesn't sound that sexy or fancy, but that's my truth. You know, I just did it every single day.
Yeah, and it's staying true to that saying of taking one day at a time that we probably would take for granted, but you've actually gone and done that, and it's proved true.
Yeah, well, I mean that advice is. Can sound a bit trite.
Yeah.
You know, take, you know, count your blessings and take things one day at a time. Mm. But I think when you break it down, they are really relevant and they are really helpful in our lives.
Well, stay with us. There's plenty more still to come on Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. Well, great to have your company on Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. I'm Laura Turner, and tonight we're chatting with Tarea Pitt. Now, Tarea, we've talked all about the incident back in 2011, which changed your life dramatically in terms of the burns that you suffered whilst running that ultra marathon in the Kimberleys. Now, and I've seen and read many interviews with you where you've said, you know, you don't like to look back in anger over what happened. It's obviously very important to you to look forward and stay positive. Mm. There was a parliamentary inquiry to what happened and it was damning of the organisers of the race that you were involved with. Racing the Planet was the company. How do you feel about that inquiry and that situation now?
Look, you know, however I felt, it wouldn't change the circumstances. Mm. So I could be really angry and I could be really pissed off, but would that change anything about what happened to me? It wouldn't. So I guess I've looked at it as, in the sense that, yeah, I could waste my energy being angry and furious and upset, but that's going to do jack all for me. Mm. You know, why don't I put all of that energy into rebuilding my life and making it as great as possible and into my rehabilitation and into doing Ironman events? Because that, for me, that's way more empowering. So I think I had a choice, and I think every day we've all got a choice.
Yeah.
And I consistently choose to look at my life in the most empowering way.
It's funny, we talked before the break about the saying of taking things one day at a time and what you're saying now about, you know, you choose to look forward, you choose to be positive. Again, they're all things that the comments that people can go, oh, yeah, you know, it's trite sort of thing. But you really do live and breathe those mottos, don't you? You are the embodiment of actually doing that.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd be like the world embodiment.
No, but you're staying true to it.
Yeah, and I mean, I talk about that stuff in Good Selfie, but I think it's also important, you know, if you're having a bad day, you don't always necessarily have to turn it around. You know, if I'm having a bad day or a crap day, it's okay for me to say, you know what, Tere, today's not a great day. Tomorrow will probably be better. And I think that's really refreshing as well, because I think these days there is an emphasis on always being positive and happy and enthusiastic. And I don't think that's a realistic portrait of life. Mm. You know, I think life is on a spectrum, and there are days which are extraordinary and magical and delightful, but there are days which are hard and challenging and tough. And I think we can't have one without the other.
Yeah, that probably,
and it's about
probably leads me to my next question. You know, you sort of said before, you're a confident young woman, and people often ask you, how do you stay confident? With the best of intentions, they ask that sort of thing. But what I wonder, Taria, is how do you, are there days where you just simply get overwhelmed by, you know, the unfairness, the injustice of what happened to you? Because, you know, I think most people would.
I got to say, Laura, no.
That's incredible.
No. Yeah. I mean, like, it's, you know, and I think maybe this might be a bit shocking to people, but I'm actually genuinely really happy, and I genuinely love my life. So when people say they feel, you know, if they feel sorry for me, I just think, oh, you're tripping. Like, I love my life. I've got an awesome partner. I've got a beautiful baby. I live in the most magical place. I get to do what I love every single day. I get to travel around the world and compete in amazing races. So I think, you know, when I look at it on the whole, I'm really happy.
You, and you, as we've talked about, have all of these massive goals that you continue to work on and persevere with. You brushed over before that you've done Ironman events and that sort of thing, but that was a big goal of yours, wasn't it, to actually compete in your first Ironman? Is that because, I refer to some research that I've done, but you've been told sort of as you recovered not to expect too much of yourself.
Yeah, that was what I found so frustrating, because I've always been a high achiever. And then, you know, because I had an accident, people's expectations of me and what I could achieve suddenly plummeted. So, you know, in hospital they would say, oh, you know, you might drive again, you might get a job, you might get married. And that was frustrating, because I thought, well, that's stuff that, you know, most people do. You know, and you're saying that for me, that would be an achievement to do things that most people in the world do. So I think that was what spurred me on to pick the goal of doing an Ironman. And I'm really grateful for the Ironman journey, because if I never decided to do an Ironman, I would have never been fit enough to do an Ironman. You know, having Ironman as my goal, that helped me to push myself, that helped me rehabilitate myself, that helped me to keep on running and keep working on myself. So I'm really grateful for it.
An Ironman takes up, and my partner's done a number of them, and it takes up a massive part of your life just training for it.
It is life consuming, Laura. Like, you can't fit in anything else when you're training for an Ironman.
Did you sorry.
You go.
I was just going to ask if during your training, I mean, did you have to consult with doctors before deciding to do it for them to get the go ahead, or did you, I'm going to go out and do this?
No, I just thought I was going to do it, but I was, you know, I got an Ironman coach. And like I said earlier, you know, just take the small steps every day. I'd look at my training program Monday. What do I have to do today? I wouldn't worry about being fit enough to do a massive 4-kilometre swim and 180-kilometre bike ride and 42-kilometre run. I would just think, what am I doing today? I'm doing a 50-metre run, which consists of, you know, five sprints. Five, you know, and I would get it done, and then I would forget about it. And then the next day would come. So that's, you know, that's a really simplistic way of looking at things, but that's how I look at things. That makes,
The day-to-day rather than the overwhelming bigger picture.
Because if you, you know, if I thought about doing an Ironman, even on the morning of it, I was like, oh, I don't know if I can do this day. I don't know if I'm fit enough. I don't know why I didn't listen to my doctors when, you know, they said it might not be a good idea. So I think you've got to be able to leave all that aside and just really focus on what you're doing in that moment or in that day.
Are there injuries that you have from the fire that have held you back in training and completing an Ironman?
Look, you know what? I think, you know, there are injuries. Like, I've only got three fingers. I find it difficult to regulate my body temperature because that's one of the functions of your skin. You know, Laura, if you're hot, your skin will sweat, which will cool you down. And if you're cold, you'll get little goosebumps, which will trap the air between the hair and your skins, and that will keep you warm. So I can't regulate my body temperature. I have difficulty getting in enough oxygen. So I think, I could have used all of those things as an excuse for not doing an Ironman, I'm not competing again, but I chose to use all of those things as motivation.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Finding a way around them and keeping going.
And I think that's pertinent to all of us, you know? Mm-hmm. We're always too busy. We always don't have enough time. We can always find a way to talk ourselves out of anything. Mm. But I think if you genuinely want something, and also you've got a super compelling reason for why, like why I wanted to do an Ironman is I wanted to prove to everyone that not only was I as fit as I was in that ultra marathon when I was catastrophically injured, but I was fitter.
Yeah.
So that was my burning, insatiable why for wanting to do an Ironman.
Yep.
So I think if you've got a really clear goal, a really crystal clear why, you can always find a way to make something happen for yourself.
How did Michael, your lovely partner, cope with you saying, I'm going to turn around and train for an Ironman now? Or did he train with you?
No, he did it, but Michael's a very cruisy guy.
Yeah.
You know, so he was like, okay, doll, if that's going to make you happy, you do that.
Yeah.
But it was funny, when I did the Ironman World Championships, there was all of these, like, super, super fit athletes around me.
Now, this is the one in Kona, Hawaii.
Yeah, this was the one in Hawaii.
A whole different ball game. It's black roads and tar, and it's boiling hot. You're on a volcano, basically. So.
Yeah, so this race is like the epitome of endurance events.
Extremely difficult, even more difficult than an Ironman here in Australia.
Yeah, and so I remember just freaking out, being like, oh, I can't do this. You know, I said to Michael, I don't want to do this Ironman. And he was so nonchalant. He was like, okay, well, if you don't want to do it, like, don't do it. It's fine, you know. And I think that's so good to have someone who doesn't put any pressure on you.
The pressure, yeah.
Yeah. But I also think Michael is very savvy in that he knows how I work.
I was just going to say that. I bet you, because that would be reverse psychology for you.
Yeah, because then I was like, well, of course I'm going to do it. Like, we flew all the way here. I'm not going to not do it. You know?
So he's smiling on the inside, thinking,
he knows how I operate, for sure.
Well, don't go anywhere. You're listening to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives, and plenty more still to come with Taria Pitt up next. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tonight, we are celebrating the life of the incredible Taria Pitt. Taria, we've talked all about your recovery and your passion and dedication to completing Ironman events and proving to yourself and to others that, you know, you can keep going and stay true to your goals despite the catastrophic injuries you suffered in that bushfire. You, aside from that, have written a number of books. You also have your online program called School of Champions, which it looks very attractive to those who, need a bit of guidance and self-belief. Is that what it's about?
Yeah, I guess so. I describe it as my program for goal getting. And I briefly touched on it before, Laura. You know, I said you need a really clear and tangible goal that you're trying to achieve. So, you know, a lot of people want to get fit, but they haven't really tapped into what that means to them. Mm. You know, does get fit mean going to yoga 3 times a week? Does it mean being CrossFit world champion? Mm. You know, so, you know, I get people to really define what their goal is. And then I back it up with saying, well, what's your reason for wanting to achieve your goal? Because when you're in the process of working towards a goal, you get into the grind and it's really easy to get demotivated because it becomes a bit monotonous, boring. You're doing the same thing every single day. Mm. And I think it's really important to have that really compelling reason for why you're trying to achieve it.
Mm. Has it proved popular, that the School of Champions?
You know what? We've had thousands of people through the school, and I really love hearing the stories of what they're doing because, you know, some people run half marathons. A woman quit her job and opened up a organic blueberry farm, which has been really successful. You know, people lose weight in the program. I think anything that's really important to them, the program helps them achieve it. And I'm really proud of that. You know, I think it's quite grounding to see that the stuff that I've developed has had a huge impact on people's lives.
Well, I think you've tapped into something that, I mean, I think it's fair to say most people suffer from, and that's getting into a rut and not knowing your way out of it and feeling frustrated with yourself that you can't be or do, you know, what it is that you want to do because you feel a little bit trapped in your own life. So I feel like what you're talking about sort of unlocks that in a way and empowers you.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's one. Is it still available now? Can we still go and do it?
Yes, yes.
I think I'm going to sign up after the show.
You sign up, Laura.
And on top of this, you were named New South Wales Premier's a Woman of the Year. You've been recognised from all quarters, haven't you, for the incredible work that you've done. You must be pretty proud of yourself all these years later.
Yeah, I am. And I think what most people don't do enough, they never stop and think about everything that they've done and the things that they're proud of, you know, because we live in this fast-paced world where you do one thing, then you quickly shift focus and think, what's next? Mm. What's better? Where can I go to? And I think that attitude is great. That's phenomenal. But it's also important to stop, reflect, and really savour and relish the things that you've achieved or you've worked out or that you're proud of.
In saying that, Taria, where do you go to now? What's next on the horizon for you?
I finished the Kathmandu Coast to Coast like 6 weeks ago.
Yep.
So I'm relishing in that, you know.
Yeah.
Like I said, I got up some mornings before the house was awake, before Hakawai was awake, and did my run. Sometimes I'd put him in the pram and take him with me to do hill sprints. So I'm proud of that. I'm savouring in that.
Yep.
And I've got this new book out, which I'm really excited about.
That is wonderful. Thank you so much for talking to us for the show tonight. It's been an absolute pleasure and an honour to have you on. Thank you, Taria.
Thank you so much, Laura. I appreciate it.
Well, join me again the same time next week when we celebrate another great Australian life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.